New York, 99.5 FM.
It's a sunny 81 degrees in New York City, a beautiful day, but a sad day as we commemorate and remember Representative John Lewis. Welcome to Coping with COVID-19. I'm Sri Srinivasan. Coping with COVID-19 is a helpful, hopeful call-in show. Today's our 17th episode, and we're so grateful to everyone who's called in and to all our guests. Thank you for supporting WBAI 99.5 listener-supported progressive radio here in New York City and worldwide on WBAI.org. Please share this show right now with your friends and family. Let them know via text messaging, WhatsApp, or via just calling them and telling them to tune on the radio and go to 99.5 FM or to WBAI.org. On this show, we discuss various aspects of the crisis, but focus on its effects on society's most vulnerable, the workers, the poor, the marginalized, and talk to ordinary citizens and experts. We learn together. A little bit about my background. I host daily shows about COVID-19 on my YouTube channel, Srinet, S-R-E-E-N-E-T, and I'm the Marshall Loeb Visiting Professor of Digital Innovation at Stony Brook University and someone who spent 25 years working at iconic New York City institutions. I was the Chief Digital Officer of Columbia, then the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and then the city itself, working in the basement of City Hall. When we started this show 17 weeks ago, New York City was the epicenter of the epicenter. We're now moving into another phase. We're getting more and more open. There's still a lot of restrictions on indoor activities, as they need to be. We are also emphasizing the importance of masks and social distancing as much as possible. Today, we're going to hear from multiple guests, but we want to hear from you, especially if you'd like to call in and talk about John Lewis and the impact of his work. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. You can email me, Sree, S-R-E-E, that's Sam Robert Edward Edward, at SREE.net. On Twitter, I'm at Sree, S-R-E-E, and at WBAI. Our hashtag is WBAI-S-R-E-E. Let me start by just reading the opening sentences from the New York Times obituary of John Lewis. Towering figure of civil rights era, dies at 80. Images of his beating at Selma shocked the nation and led to swift passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. He was later called the conscience of the Congress. And the opening sentences are like this. Representative John Lewis, a son of sharecroppers and an apostle of nonviolence, who was bloodied at Selma and across the Jim Crow South in the historic struggle for racial equality, and who then carried a mantle of moral authority into Congress, died on Friday. He was 80. His death was confirmed in a statement by Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Mr. Lewis, a Georgia Democrat, announced on December 29th that he had stage 4 pancreatic cancer and vowed to fight it with the same passion with which he had battled racial injustice. I've been in some kind of fight for freedom, equality, basic human rights for nearly my entire life, he said. On the front lines of the bloody campaign to end Jim Crow laws, with blows to his body and a fractured skull to prove it, Mr. Lewis was a valiant steward of the civil rights movement and the last surviving speaker from the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963. That's how the New York Times obituary by Catherine Q. Seeley starts. And it will go on and on and on, as will go on the tributes and attention paid to the passing of Representative John Lewis. Today on this show, we're on the air for 2 hours. We'd like to hear from you. We want to hear your voices. Please call in and talk to us. We have two guests who are here on the show, but we want all of you to participate. For the first hour, we have Mary C. Curtis with us. She's an award-winning columnist, writer, speaker, editor. She writes for Roll Call, but has also contributed to NPR, NBC News, The Washington Post, The Root, and many other publications. She's going to discuss with us today the life and impact of Congressman John Lewis and the impact he's had on our society. For our second hour, we'll be joined by Tahitun Mariam. She's the founder of the Bronx Mutual Aid Network, a longtime community activist and organizer who's been living and working in the Bronx, focusing on immigrant justice, civic engagement, and building community power through political education. She's also a poet and writer. She'll join us at the 1 p.m. Eastern Time hour. For now, we start with Mary C. Curtis and the legacy of John Lewis. Hello, Mary.
Hi, how are you this morning? I am just heartbroken, but inspired as well. John Lewis, who I covered somewhat, I've met him a few times. I cover the intersection of politics, culture, and race, but I've known him in a sense all my life. He is, when people say he's a civil rights icon, he's, I think, an American icon, the quintessential person who had such an impact, but with such humble beginnings. You know, the son of a sharecroppers in Alabama who used to take care of the chickens and preach to them. That's how he practiced his preaching. And he was there. And people forget just how young a person he was, a young man, when he was putting his soul and his body on the line for rights and knew he could get killed. Everyone has seen that image of him having his skull cracked on the Edmund Pettus Bridge there, marching for voting rights. And he has blood streaming down his face, and he's helping women get up. He's helping other people. And that is the gentle, in a sense, he was a fighter, but such a gentle human being. And before I became a journalist, my life was involved in a way with civil rights. I'm the youngest of five children, and my three older siblings were involved in the civil rights movement. And before I even had a sense of what they were doing, they would meet in our homes. And all three of them were in the March on Washington. And I remember speaking to my sister, my oldest sister, now deceased Joan, who was there. And she said, well, everyone talks about Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream. She said, but I was a young person, and I really related to the message of the speech of John Lewis. Because he had to tone it down a little bit, the organizers. He was speaking of revolution and we can't wait. And they were saying, oh, I don't know about that. But so he spoke to those young people of the time, and he's still speaking to the young people of Black Lives Matter who are marching. And I just cannot say enough. You know, we lost also C.T. Vivian, civil rights pioneer, a wonderful American, the same day, earlier that day. And you have a feeling that this generation is is going. John Lewis was the last of the folks who spoke at the March on Washington who was alive. But I heard Andrew Young speaking this morning about John Lewis, and he was saying the line between life and death is slim, and you still have a feeling that his spirit is with us. You can see all of these messages coming from politicians and people of both parties, and well, we'll see. Everything is very partisan now. He marched for voting rights, so we'll see if that voting legislation that's been sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk. I saw Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, the Republicans' beautiful statement, and people are saying, well, I wonder if in his name, John Lewis's name, they will act on voting rights. So I don't know about that, but I think while folks in this country are thinking about racial inequities, that thinking about John Lewis is a good place to reflect, a good sense to reflect. And, well, I'll let folks get in, but those are my initial thoughts. Also that, yeah, I don't want to get too political, but look at the contrast in leadership that we have. And even the later, you saw a picture of him not too long ago standing on the Black Lives Matter mural in Washington on the streets, and he was wearing a mask, you know. That was
Thank you, Mary. That was such a wonderful way to start our conversation, and you really brought it all together for us. I'm so grateful. Everyone, we're talking to Mary Curtis, commentator, political journalist, who knows so much about the intersection of race and politics in this country. And she's going to be with us for the hour. Please call in with your questions and comments. And if you have a story about John Lewis, whether you met him in person or from a distance or just watched him on TV, this is your chance to jump in here and talk to us, share your thoughts, 212-209-2877. Today, I was listening to the Reverend Raphael G. Warnock, who is the pastor of Representative Lewis. And I keep saying Reverend because I know he wanted to be a preacher. As you said, Mary, he was practicing with the chickens. And Reverend Warnock had a great line. He said that instead of becoming someone who delivered sermons, Representative Lewis became a sermon. His life itself became a sermon. And there's incredible. I've spent part of my morning reading his Twitter feed at Rep. John Lewis. Everyone should do that. You will smile, you will cry, you will get angry at the state of this country. And as you said, Mary, it's been 60 years, six decades, and so little has changed, and people are still on the streets marching, fighting, and often those are young people leading the way now, as John Lewis did as a young man himself. Mary, what is your message about the legacy of John Lewis for young people?
Well, he was an optimist. When people would say things haven't changed, he would say, well, I don't know if I agree with that, because look at me. I was the son of sharecroppers, not many generations out of enslavement, and I am a member of Congress. I am here. I am speaking. I am using my voice. So that would be it. I would say for young people to read his speech, both the original and the edited version at the March on Washington, because he talked about getting out into the streets and not being patient, because some older civil rights folks, well, as I said, they said to him, you know, you have to tone this down. And he had that impatience as well. So I would say to look at his spirit and to see that he did not give up. He did not give up. And I would say that that would be the optimism. And to realize that he was getting inspiration from the young people today. And that is something great. To build on his legacy. And I would say, don't get frustrated. To me, I get a little frustrated, I have to tell you, when I realize that he was marching about voting rights, and you see all these years later, 80 years old, he was still fighting that same fight in many ways as the states have initiated restrictions on voting in the light of the Supreme Court invalidating portions in 2013 of the Voting Rights Act. And Congress hasn't acted on it. And the latest Supreme Court ruling that is going to, for the time being, leave the Florida vote. They voted that former felons, ex-felons, could get the right to vote. And then the legislature came in and said, well, they had to pay their fines first. And that means that a lot may not be able to vote. And so there are always setbacks. But with progress, there will always be pushback. And he realized that, but he still had that optimism. He's the kind of person that would stop and talk to anybody. School children making a tour. I have to say, the first time I met him, I was kind of embarrassing probably because I was in the presence of John Lewis, but he was such a down-to-earth person. So I would not say be patient because that's not who he was, but I would just say to look and build on what he started. This was a man that people who beat him came and asked for forgiveness, and he listened to them and befriended them and talked with them. And he is a human being, and he would certainly say he was all too human. But look at what he did and what he was able to do and who he was able to inspire. I certainly think of him when I get a little bit frustrated with things, not moving as fast as I would like, or not getting through to some people. So that would be my message. But he said in one of his, I was looking at some of his speeches and reading and looking at his videos in preparation for this conversation, and he said, if you see something that's not right, you have the moral obligation to do something. So I will let his words speak for him.
Thank you. I'm getting teary-eyed having this conversation, but it's so important that we have it. And we're so grateful to you, Mary Curtis, for being here with us. Folks, check out Mary Curtis on Twitter. She's MCurtisNC for North Carolina 3. She shared a beautiful photo of you with him. I don't know if that was the first time or one of the many times you met him. But talk about his presence, because I will share my story about him in a minute. But I want you to go first, Mary.
Well, no, that was an event, and I think he was in Charlotte, which is one of my offices in Washington at Roll Call, and you can see all my work at marycurtis.com. But that was an event, I think a scholarship event, Black Scholars event in Charlotte, and it was formal, so we were all dressed up, and he was taking time particularly with the young people because there were young people getting scholarships, very much tongue-tied, very much in awe. I have to say, I was older, but I was pretty tongue-tied as well. And he just puts everyone at ease, as I said. And he always is speaking about the moral obligation to do something. And that was his speech that night to the young people. That was his message. And I thought it was so great that he did get to see Barack Obama become president, because that was part of what he had worked for. And apparently in 2008, Barack Obama signed one of the programs of the inauguration because of you, John. And in 2012, at the second inauguration, he whispered to him, it's still because of you. And I saw Barack and Michelle Obama had a beautiful memory and remembrance that they have put out. I would also encourage people to look at that as well. Your meeting with him, Sri?
No, thank you. And we will be reading from the Barack Obama or Michelle Obama statement in a little bit. My meeting with him, I had the honor of being in his presence more than once at various events, but once I was emceeing a gala where he was honored. This was the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund Gala. Juju Chang and I, many of you know her from ABC, had the honor of honoring him. And we got a few minutes together on the sidelines. And I took a selfie that's now my Twitter image, at SREE. You can see the picture. And even as we're taking the picture, he's talking. You know, that's one of my enduring memories of him, that you want to listen to every word he's saying, and you want to grab onto those words. And he just, one of the things he said that night has stayed with me forever. He said, we all came to America on different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. That was 2013. And think about today. We are in the same boat now. A city that was under siege is slowly opening up in New York, but your part of the country, North Carolina, Texas, Florida, California, are in such deep trouble. And that's just on the medical front. What about the financial situation? What about race relations and equality? And to have him had a chance for his own success, but to see Barack Obama was especially powerful. And I'm getting emotional here, as you can hear. Let's go to a caller. We want to hear from all of you. We know you want to chat about Representative Lewis. Please, I keep calling him Reverend, but I think of him as a preacher. If you would all please call in, we have the 2 hours on the show. We will bring as many voices as we can. 212-209-2877. Let's go to a caller now. Please tell us where you're calling from and your name, please.
I'm up in White Plains. It's Russell Street. In the spirit of saying something, when you see something that's not right, saying something, it was interesting to hear the story about John Lewis compromising in 1963. I'd forgotten about that because it provided a bookend to the end of his life in 2020 when he compromised by arranging that deal to have Biden selected and taking away the rights of the Democratic rank and file to select their person. John Lewis erased much of his record of good work by making this compromise at the end. And I think when you're in your 80s, I think they should think about getting out of the, off the stage. Pelosi, let me bring up another 80-year-old, said we won't open the schools because some parents have, quote, angst. There will always be parents with angst. You know what we should do? Stop eating animals, because extinguishing animals' life is not a good thing. Human health is not just the absence of pathogens. And if you want to hear another negative thing, I'll tell you, three, about the masks, okay? Hello?
Sorry, 1 second. Russell, thank you very much. Thank you for your call.
All right.
This is, I appreciate your call. This is not a show where we talk about masks in a way that is, we know that masks work. That's one of the reasons where New York is compared to the rest of the country. And this is on a day, hours after the death of John Lewis. We do not tolerate people calling in to just criticize him. You had nothing nice to say about him, and I'm sorry that we had to cut you off, but I appreciate your calling. You've called in many times, and we have spoken in the past, but today is a day we are honoring John Lewis. There will always be time to look at a person's full life, in 80 years of someone's life. I'm much younger. I'm only 50. My life is full of flaws, and to see what this man did was incredible. Let's get another caller. You're on the air on WBAI. Tell us your name and where you're calling in from, please.
Hi there. My name, L, from Long Island, and I hope that I'm able to complete what I wish to state. The gentleman who previously spoke, I would have loved to hear his full comment. I think that at a time when someone passes, that it should be a time that, especially if you have the means, and that is by the medium of television, radio, or cable, or internet, or what have you, I think if you're going to open lines, it would be courteous to give a person the opportunity to voice their opinion, because it helps when you hear different opinions on a subject, on a person. It also encourages people who are listening to go and seek information to validate what has been said or to void it so that they can be at a level of knowing and not just receiving and regurgitating other thoughts. That being said, John Lewis did many things in his life. And we as a people, we as his people, will evaluate the merits of his doings. That's number one. Number two, we cannot say that everyone, and that is youth is, that is, should be following in examples of what he did. Keep in mind that apartheid had the leadership and had the power of youth who gave up their lives in South Africa to bring that down. It was youth. The youth out here on the street, They may not have all the answers, but one thing that they do have the strength and the conviction not to be bought off with appointments or being given certain interests in companies or being able to be on radio and television, internet, and become millionaires without having done a day's work in reference to actually working for the money. That's honorable. So I think that to summarize everything and so that another caller can get on, I think that we should listen to what others say and not be so opinionated in our own ways that we don't give them the opportunity to educate us by listening and seeking information.
Thank you, Elle, for your call. And I will say to everyone listening that we do want other voices on this show. But I will also say that when we are suffering from great pain in the world because of disinformation and misinformation from the highest office of this land, from media folks who lie about the effect of distancing, about the importance of keeping schools safe, on the importance of masks. This show, my show, is about giving accurate information. And I cut off people who engage in actively dismissing accurate information or inject fake information into this. We are, as a country, in a very thin line. When the vaccine comes, if it comes, the only way we're going to get through this if people accept that that is a way forward. Otherwise, thanks to this president, thanks to Jenny McCarthy, and thanks to, on the other side, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., vaccines have been demonized in this country, and we will, as a country, suffer because millions of people, tens of millions of people, will not listen and will not take the sound medical advice. That's what we're seeing right now. 17, 18 states have to go back into lockdown because of the misinformation spouted off by the president and his governors who are not listening to science. And on this show, I will not tolerate that. There are plenty of places on the internet for everybody to talk about anything they want. But on this show and this day, we are here to celebrate the life of John Lewis. I'm going to read from the opening of an incredible package of stories on the AJC. That's the Atlanta Journal-Constitution website, AJC.com. And then I'm going back to Mary Curtis to hear her thoughts. Tamar Hollerman has written a multi-chapter obituary about the life and legacy of John Lewis. And here's how it starts. Before the sit-ins and freedom rides, before nearly dying at the hand of an Alabama state trooper at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and before ascending to the top ranks of Democratic politics, John Lewis wanted to be a preacher. As a young boy tending to his family's chickens in rural Pike County, Alabama, the future Georgia congressman would assemble the landfowl onto their roosts and recite Bible verses to them nearly every evening. He even conducted funeral services and the occasional baptism. Lewis's central role in the civil rights movement put an end to his pulpit dreams, but his moral clarity and unwavering commitment to nonviolence and the beloved community, a democracy of racial, social, and economic equality, infused every chapter of his life, and it also earned him the respect of a nation that early on feared his presence. Lewis, who played a 60-year outsized role on America's stage, from organizing lunch counter sit-ins to becoming the face of political resistance to President Donald Trump, died Friday after a battle with cancer. His office confirmed he was 80 years old. Mary Curtis, commentator, journalist, political writer, person who has met John Lewis, your thoughts?
Well, I really listened to your last caller, Elle, and it is interesting when she talked about the youth, because when you see him as an 80-year-old man, that's why I brought up the fact that when he was so young, when he was putting his life on the line. And there were elders. Many people at that point felt that you had to go through the legal system. You had to change the laws, and that's when the rights would come. And he and others, many of them also so young, including, as I said, in my own family, I didn't realize or honor that until later, how much they were putting their lives on the line, said, no, we want to be free now. We want to be free now. And then not too long ago, a few years ago, after the so much gun violence in the schools, he and colleagues sat in on the floor of Congress because they would not discuss gun bills. And several of his colleagues, particularly those on the other side of the aisle, dismissed it as a stunt. And he was still using that civil disobedience. Because when you look at it, actually, he was, in those early days, breaking the law of the land, because the law was separate, was segregation. And the people who beat him were agents of the state. They were law enforcement. And so you could go into perhaps one of those jails and not come out, even when you were taken into custody. So I think that is a certain amount of courage that I think is difficult for people to even grasp. Do you believe in something so much that you would be willing to die for it? And I do think, as the caller said, in many cases, young people do lead the way because there's a certain fearlessness that says, yes, I will do whatever needs to be done. But he was that young man, and he was still doing that as a senior sage. And I think that's what I believe. That's what I think about him. And yes, did he have flaws? Yes, we all do. But I've met people in covering this, icons like John Lewis, like Franklin McCain, who was one of the people who did the original sit-in in the lunch counter in Greensboro in 1960. And what gets me when you speak to any of them is they all feel like they still have so much to do, that the job is still not done, and there's no time to rest. I've talked to Reverend William Barber. I interviewed him for Time Magazine, and he basically has a debilitating physical illness, but his thing is there are people suffering so many ways in this society. How can I not do something? And that is just, I would say, just sit in that for a minute. You know, we have so many people getting upset because they have to wear a mask in a store. And then that is too much of an inconvenience. And then to think what John Lewis and others, C.T. Vivian, the folks like that did, and they benefited us. Everyone. I like to say when people feel that they just did it for African Americans or whatever, no, they liberated everyone in this country. They helped with that. So, yes, it would take more than a show to honor that spirit and to just sit in that courage.
Thank you, Mary. C.T. Vivian was an American minister, author, and close friend and lieutenant of Martin Luther King Jr. during the Civil Rights Movement. He resided in Atlanta, Georgia, and he is one of two civil rights icons that we lost in one day, the same day as John Lewis. I want to, before we go to some more callers, I want to read from Barack Obama's statement on the passing of Representative John Lewis. Mary, I'm going to try to get through this without tearing up. America is a constant work in progress. What gives each new generation purpose is to take up the unfinished work of the last and carry it further, to speak out for what's right, to challenge an unjust status quo, and to imagine a better world. John Lewis, one of the original freedom riders, chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the youngest speaker at the March on Washington, leader of the march from Selma to Montgomery, member of Congress representing the people of Georgia for 33 years, not only assumed that responsibility, he made it his life's work. He loved this country so much that he risked his life and his blood so that it might live up to its promise. And through the decades, he not only gave all of himself to the cause of freedom and justice, he inspired generations that followed to try to live up to his example. I first met John when I was in law school, Barack Obama writes, and I told him that he was one of my heroes. Years later, when I was elected a U.S. senator, I told him that I stood on his shoulders. When I was elected president of the United States, I hugged him on the inauguration stand before as I was sworn in and told him I was only there because of the sacrifices he made. And through all those years, he never stopped providing wisdom and encouragement to me and Michelle and our family. We will miss him dearly. And that's just part of the comments that he wrote. Everyone, please find that on the internet, read it, savor it, and understand that photograph of multiple pictures of Barack Obama with John Lewis, what that says about the promise of this country, the progress of this country, and still how much more there is still to go for this country. Let's talk now to one of our callers. You're on the air on WBAI. Tell us where you're calling from, please.
Hi, this is George. I'm calling from New Jersey. How are you?
Thank you for being here.
Yeah. What district was he from again? I forgot.
He's from Georgia. He's from Pike County.
Okay. How's that doing now?
I'm sorry?
How is that county doing now? How is his hometown doing now? How is his area doing it as far as their situation right now?
Oh, with COVID-19, I know Georgia is in terrible shape because the governor is forcing people not to wear masks. In fact, when Atlanta put in a mask order, he is now reversing that. Imagine the gall of a governor who would do something like that to kill his own people.
I know.
That is what is happening right now in Atlanta and all across Georgia.
Could you just tell me, just one question about that? How does 140,000 people out of 360 million people call for a pandemic? This is no pandemic. This is a hoax.
A hoax?
You got to grow the hell up.
We're going to take you off the air. We have no time for this. People are dying. To call this a hoax is unacceptable. It is not a hoax. I'm going to read from you in a little bit a comment from one of my friends who has COVID-19 right now. There is no hoax in this. This is a tragedy. People are dying, and people are dying because of governors like Kemp, President Trump, Governor DeSantis. People are dying today in this country. America has the worst results of this pandemic, the worst, because of the people like that caller who have been brainwashed by Fox News and people like that, who don't understand that this country is in danger. This is the biggest danger to this country since the Civil War, not just about the health, but also finance and where we are as a country. Mary, your thoughts. I'm getting worked up here, Mary.
Well, I do have friends who I have had it. I have a good friend who had COVID very early on, and he is a very healthy person. He runs, and he is coming back, but this is months later. He still has not gotten back his sense of smell, and when he has started to exercise, he has to stop and rest. This is quite serious, and some other countries that I believe South Korea had their first fatality the same time we did, the same day, in fact. And now they're coming back, their schools and so forth. They have a lot of testing, tracing. When somebody tests positive, they can contact all of the people that person has contacted. And I think when we want to talk, to bring this back to Lewis, Representative John Lewis, we can talk about systemic racism in this country. And we see even here, because black and brown Americans are more likely to be essential workers, perhaps live in closed situations, not have health insurance, be victims of or subject to medical bias, that they are disproportionately affected. And that is a very real problem. And we can see it not just in policing, but in health care, in housing, in schooling. With the schools being out, we can see certain kids don't have as much internet access. So the issues of inequity that we are dealing with, and that John Lewis was speaking about, protesting, legislating about his whole life and career, we can see it bubbling up in every situation, including COVID. And this is serious. And it has changed our society, but we can see in states like California that did well, that may have reopened too soon, there are surges. So the fact when there are very real people dying from this, Congressman Lewis's colleague, Representative Maxine Waters, I believe, lost a sister to it. I think things that are not political are political now. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has worked with both Democrats and Republicans over the years on issues such as SARS and the Ebola outbreak, is now being demonized by some because he's just saying, follow the science. This is
it
a very
difficult situation, time. Mary, where being pro-science, pro-truth, pro-facts makes you anti-Trump. That is the equation that people have made, and it is so ridiculous. I'm so upset about the situation. Just on our show last week, on this hour, we had Dr. Monica Gutierrez from San Antonio. She is the chair of the Rehab Medical Medicine Department, and she's telling us of how people have to rehab after COVID. It takes months to get better, if they get better, if they don't die. Young people are going to rehab to learn how to eat, walk, etc. again. And to call that a hoax, to say 99% of cases are harmless, that's what this president said. How is that even possible as a way for this country to move forward? Impossible.
Yeah. And everybody wants to get back to schools. Everybody wants that. To be very silly about it, I love my theater. Everybody wants things to go back to normal, but we have to sacrifice as a country. When you go into a store, you can't smoke a cigarette. You have to be wearing clothes, shoes. This is something that is such a small ask that the scientists have said works. And even if we do get a vaccine, when we get one, there'll be some time to test it. This is not immediate that we can snap our fingers and make pretend it does not exist. I don't get it either. You know, during the world wars, when people rationed food and had sacrifice for your neighbors, when you wear a mask, it's to protect your neighbors from you because you can be asymptomatic and spread it. It is such a small ask, yet we have these videos of people going in and literally haranguing these poor minimum wage workers that are helping us get our food and our supplies.
They lose their mind as those videos, yeah. You've seen them, you're absolutely right. And we are now left in a position where Walmart, of all companies, is showing leadership by insisting people wear masks when governors and presidents are not. How did it come to be that Walmart is a company that I'm saying good things about on this show?
Oh, yeah. Well, we saw here in Charlotte that they were going to have the Republican convention. But we have a Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, and they just wanted a plan from the Republican committee of how they were going to do that. Would there be social distancing and masks? Would there be a limit? How were they going to regulate it? And they were in negotiations, but then the president tweeted that he wanted a full convention, 20,000, big place for giving a speech. So they moved the bulk of it. Not the business meet, but the bulk to Jacksonville, Florida. Well, now Florida is a spiking hot spot. And
yes.
Now Florida is saying, Jacksonville, you can't have everybody come. You're going to have, so they are ending up making negotiations that are very similar to ones that were asked for by the state of North Carolina. In a sense, they have to make the same rules that they were going to have to make, but pretty much they took it elsewhere. And that was a difficult decision. They just were asking to negotiate a plan that would work for everyone. It seems like people are in their corners and everything is partisan. And as I said, John Lewis was an American in so many ways. And at 80 years old, he was wearing his mask.
And he knew, he understood, and he followed the science, and we're so grateful to him and his legacy. A few weeks ago, we had on the show the writer Sapphire, whose novel Push became the Oscar-winning Precious, and she tweeted today, R.I.P. John Lewis, I'm reading Mary Trump's book. It makes me realize even more how valuable people of integrity and moral courage are. What a loss, especially at this time in our history. Please follow Sapphire. She's new to Twitter. She's Miss Saff, M-S-S-A-P-P-H on Twitter. And you can actually listen to our entire conversation with her and the righteous anger that she has. One of the things, Mary, she told me that we are here talking about wash your hands. There are native reservations on this country where in this country where there's no running water. So what are we talking about? Wash your hands. And she brought me to understand a lot about what's happening. So please follow her on Twitter. And by the way, the big anniversary is coming up of that book and tells you about the passage of time. We have another caller. You're on the air on WBAI. Tell us where you're calling from and your name, please.
My name is Carla, and I'm calling from New Jersey.
Welcome.
And everything's legal in New Jersey.
So, yes, it is. That's a line from Hamilton, Carla.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I'm calling because John Lewis, you know, for many young people now, John Lewis was an older statesman of the civil rights movement, and they don't have the memories of him as a young man. But the whole battle for equality is an ongoing thing. And so I went to elementary school in Memphis in the 1960s. And I just wanted to mention that the work that John Lewis has done has made tremendous change, even though we still need tremendous change in the future. But I remember that in our neighborhood, which was just a middle-class neighborhood, there were it was an all-white neighborhood, and everybody in the neighborhood had a black maid who came and did the house cleaning, and in some cases the house cleaning and the child care and the meal preparation. And I know we had a maid come once a week, and for the entire day of house cleaning that she did, it was a full day, working hard all day except for her lunch break, she was paid $5. And there were no benefits. There was, you know, nothing in addition to that. And really the only quote unquote benefit was that my mother gave her lunch when she came. But that's a long, hard day of work for $5. And that was considered the norm. Now, we would not consider that the norm today. And so, you know, what I'm hoping is that young people who have been so energetic and have been so active in the wake of the George Floyd murder in Minnesota, that will continue forward, and that people will continue to see that, as Martin Luther King said, you know, none of us have freedom if there is one of us who doesn't have freedom. So, you know, we need to continue to move forward in terms of making sure that justice is not denied to anybody.
Thank you, Carla, for your call. Truly appreciate it. Mary, your thoughts?
I really took in what Carla said because I remember similar scenes of in my own childhood and growing up, and people who did sacrifice and would take that $5 and give it to their child who was in law school because he was in a predominantly white law school, and they offered him a job serving in the dining room, and his parents said they're going to take every extra job, scrub every floor, because they didn't want him waiting on the children that he would be sitting next to in class. That was my brother, by the way, and my parents. And so many families, like Carla's, who didn't know where those maids went when they went home. And that's what they were doing. And I would say that's what strikes me, in a sense. Sometimes when I think of our current president, Trump, one thing I wonder is why he's so angry and needy, because he had so much. He had wealth, connections. He slid into his father's business. When he went bankrupt, he was bailed out. He's so angry. And someone like a John Lewis, the son of sharecroppers, a family not that many generations out of enslavement, preaching to the chickens. I believe he didn't have a phone even. On their farm, they didn't have plumbing, electricity. But he believed in America. He was in a racist, segregated society, went to segregated schools. But he believed in the promise, unfilled, but the promise that was in the words. And that's why when some people say that they accuse, whether it's Colin Kaepernick or anyone, of being African-Americans of being unpatriotic, I said, well, no, they're more patriotic in a sense because they believe in something that hasn't been real to them. And John Lewis was like that. He knew that in America he was a free man, and he wanted that to be true in how he was treated, in, you know, having the fundamental right to vote, to education, to all of these things. And that's what I think. That's why it's hard to even put it into words, because to act on that hope is an incredible act of faith and of love and an aspiration. And when I see so many of our leaders that have so much, whether it's money or privilege or whatever, and they have an anger in them, I just want to ask why? Why? When people who have so little and have had to work so hard have such an open heart.
So well put, Mary. Thank you for that. It's just something that I think a lot about, and I'm waiting to read Mary Trump's book. Have you had a chance to glance at it yet?
No, but I did watch her interview, and I was struck by so much that she said about a president not taking responsibility, because to do that would have to say that he has failed in some things and he has to do better. And at some point, when she was asked why she didn't say anything earlier, and she said she felt that others would rein him in. But then she said, when people say, this isn't who we are as Americans, and she said, this is exactly who we are. And that was something that stuck with me very much. She's a very smart woman, and she has said she doesn't come in this pure. She admits, I have had disputes with the family over money and all of that, but this is the story. This is the Donald I know, and I found it very revelatory.
And by the way,
I also think that it's not something that people didn't already know in many cases. He is, New Yorkers in particular, knew the man who had discriminated against black people in the housing. He and his father and were sued, who had taken the ad out about the Central Park Five, the Exonerated Five, who had made incendiary statements over the years, who had gone bankrupt, even though he said he was a great businessman. New Yorkers pretty much knew the whole story. And now I guess America is finding out more and more, and what they think about it and how they act on it. Well, I don't know. We will see in November, because is this who we are? Is this who we are? Or are we more like John Lewis? Someone, a flawed human being, but one who wanted to work toward a more perfect union and even put his life and his body on the line to do it and to believe in that to the end of his life. Who are we, Asri? I don't know that I have the answer to that.
And let's not forget that it's not like she had some dispute over money. Of course, that was true with Mary Trump, but Donald Trump cut off people in his own family when he could engineer more access to money himself. So this was not, you know, so there's a lot of baggage there, but that's also the book itself makes clear, and I'm looking forward to reading it. A comedian had a great line. She said that in 2015, we're saying President Trump, you know, when he was only a candidate, that don't, you know, you're killing me. It's so funny. And now we're saying President Trump is killing me. And that's what you're seeing in the brainwashed people who call into shows like this, who spread lies through Twitter and WhatsApp and Facebook. this is what the legacy we're leaving and living through right now. I want everyone to go to MaryCCurtis.com and check out her terrific website. There are photographs of her with Julian Castro, when he was San Antonio mayor, Rick Santorum. Didn't expect to see him there, but there he is. I see Jill Biden. I see Barack Obama. I just see a career of a political journalist who has interviewed Kamala Harris and has told the stories of politics and race and that intersection, and a wonderful picture of you with First Lady Michelle Obama.
Yes, I know her husband is, she had such a bestseller. He has a lot to live up to.
That's
it was
right.
Great to hear their speech about their memories of John Lewis and what they owe to him. And I've seen something from the White House in general, but I have not heard anything from this current president on a John Lewis. He in the past has tweeted terrible things about him. And I wonder, I think that's interesting too, because from our presidents, we've always expected in moments of crisis or stress, no matter what party, a certain amount of leadership, whether it's Ronald Reagan at the Challenger or Bill Clinton after Oklahoma City or President Barack Obama. I went to the funeral of the non-parishioners who were killed in Charleston, and he was there with leadership. And I don't
Sorry,
think
Mary, can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah, we don't expect that.
Mary, yes. Sorry to interrupt, but we are coming up against a hard stop. Would you join us
okay.
at the top of the hour? Would you stay with us?
Definitely.
For a little while? Thank you. I know you have much to share. We also have another great guest coming on to talk to us. Taito and Miriam will be here from the Bronx Mutual Aid Network. We'll continue taking calls about John Lewis. We have a couple of callers on hold. If everyone will please come back after this at the top of the hour, we're going to play a song to take us out through the one to the top of the show. We're going to listen to the wonderful song Stand By Me.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me, stand by me. If the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble, just as long as you stand by me. And darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand now. Stand by me. Stand by me. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to WBAI, Stand By Me, the classic song. We all need to stand by each other, especially today, as we remember the legacy of Representative John Lewis, who died yesterday at the age of 80. We have been talking to Mary Curtis, political journalist who writes about the intersection of politics and race. She was with us for the entire hour and has been very kind to stay on. We'll come back to her in just a moment. You're listening to Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. My name is Sri Srinivasan, and it's my honor to host this show. We've been at it for 17 weeks. We have seen the sun come out in New York. We have seen us move now to another phase. We have seen us go from epicenter and basket case to having hope and seeing the rest of the country, many parts of this country, fall apart the way we fell apart. I am so proud of New Yorkers and everything we've done, but the battle isn't over. We all need to be socially distant, wear masks, pay attention, wash your hands. All of these are so simple things that we can do. We heard from Mary Curtis, who said that people are getting upset about wearing a mask in a store. Learn from John Lewis, who wore his mask, but also grew up the son of sharecroppers and had so much trouble and did not have running water and did not have indoor plumbing, and look where he reached, and was always optimistic, was always positive in a way that is not common in today's world, at a time when we're separated by so many and people will continue to divide us. He stood apart because he reached out. And yes, he and Donald Trump had their words, especially over many aspects of the coronavirus and the Trump administration's awful legacy. But John Lewis was a man who was always positive, always looking for a way to work with and along with the other side. It's now been 18 hours since President Trump has done any tweeting and has not spoken about John Lewis on Twitter. I have not had a chance to watch television yet. Someone may tell us that he has in fact issued a beautiful, meaningful, honest, real statement, but I doubt that very much. There will be a statement coming, I'm sure. There's something from the White House, I'm sure. But the Trump that we know has yet to speak and yet to share his thoughts. I want to, before we go to Mary, read from President Obama's comments. He's got a Medium post up that you can find. And he said about John Lewis, he loved this country so much that he risked his life and his blood so that it might live up to its promise. And through the decades, he not only gave all of himself to the cause of freedom and justice, but inspired generations that followed to try to live up to his example. What are we doing to live up to that example? What are we doing to try and make this country a better place, a less divided place, a country that can come out of the worst crisis since the Civil War? How do we go forward from here? What do we do? And how do we make sure that we have a path forward? We have two wonderful guests who are here. One has been here since the noon hour, an hour ago. She's been so kind. Mary Curtis, please follow her, MCurtisNC3. MaryCCurtis.com. She's a writer, speaker, columnist, award-winning journalist. Mary, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
We're so kind. You're so kind to be with us. We're also joined by Taitun Merriam of the Bronx Mutual Aid Network, and she is a longtime community activist and organizer who's been living in the Bronx, focusing on immigrant justice, civic engagement, and building community power through political education, and she's also a poet and writer. Welcome, Taitun.
Thank you so much, Sri. I really, really appreciate having the opportunity to join the conversation.
Thank you, and we'll come to you in a minute. We want everyone to look up the Bronx Mutual Aid Network, and we'll talk about that work. And Mary, it was important to me to have you here today with us to talk about this issue of John Lewis and his legacy. So I'm going to give you a few moments to give us your final thoughts, and then we'll let you get back to your Saturday.
Well, thank you. My final thoughts is, well, my Saturday, I'm going to carry him with me, the spirit of John Lewis, of not letting small things trying to get in my way, bother me, hold me up, keep me from achieving what I want to in this world for the sake of moving the culture, moving forward. We have generations that are coming up that basically I benefited from a lot of the work that John Lewis did, folks of my generation being able to speak our voice from my parents. And I would feel that if I left this earth and didn't do something for the next generations coming up, why was I here? And that's a lesson I will get from the wonderful American, true American, great icon, John Lewis, that I had the honor to have interacted with on a small way. But there's so much I can do to carry that on. So I want you to thank you, Sri, for having me on just to get a little, as I said, I want to leave with what, you know, he said that if you see something that's not right, you have the moral obligation to do something. It's simple words, and I couldn't put it any better. So thank you again.
Thank you. And he did all he could to change America for the better. And that's why we're celebrating him today. Before you go, Mary, what do you say to people who feel like the change still isn't coming fast enough? I've had people call in when we have had African-American guests who are leaders in the American community, in the New York community, calling in and saying, you're not doing enough. You're moving too slowly. You're part of the old line establishment. I'm not saying you, obviously, but that we're not doing things to move faster. What do you say to them?
Well, I would agree. We could move faster and do more and do better. So I would just say, I agree. So that's why we need you. That's why we need all of everyone to be a part of the change and not sit back. We could be moving faster.
And I could let you go.
I'm sorry. No, I was just saying, you know, even now I'm thinking with COVID, we're going to have evictions coming up. What are we doing on the housing front? There's so much. But I would say to people, rather than get overwhelmed with what is not being done, to take the little piece that you can do. What can you do in your neighborhood, among your circle of friends? What is it? Break it up into a small piece so you don't get overwhelmed. Because it is easy to look at the state of things in 2020 and say, oh, my goodness. But look at John Lewis, born with nothing and having to work so hard. He could have given up as well, and he didn't. So,
by the way, he could have also cashed in on his fame and gone to the private sector and only spent his life there. He did not need to do this, and he did such a beautiful job when he did go into this. I can't let you go, the great political reporter that you are. What is your message to people who think this election is over, that Biden is a shoo-in to be president, that there is no way Trump will win this election?
I would say John Lewis got his head cracked open on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, almost was killed. Medgar Evers was shot in his driveway after surviving World War II, right? These people shed blood for our right to vote. I vote for everything, even if there's one person on the ballot, I vote, because to not vote, to say, oh, it's not, it's raining, or my candidate is a shoo-in, or whatever, no matter, I'm saying whatever the person you want to vote for, I would be disrespecting their sacrifice if I didn't use my vote, which is, if you don't have money, if you don't have the power, if you don't have lobbies, you have the vote. And we have enough people nowadays who are looking, and I'm a political journalist, so I'm covering this. There's millions of dollars being put on to keep certain people from voting, former felons, to keep give poor people, you need this many IDs. Even if you don't have a license, you need an ID for the people who are disabled, for college students, saying this ID will work, but this won't work. We're gonna purge your name. We're going to take away the ballot places in your neighborhood, so you're going to have to travel far, and you don't have a car. There are so many people still, which is why John Lewis was still fighting. So So I would say to people, this is something really precious, and you know it's precious because people want to take it away from you. Use your vote. That is something you have, and no one can take it away from you. So you can't be there. Get your absentee ballot. Do everything you need to do, because this, you don't want to the next day and say, oh, but I thought. Oh, I was counting on. Oh, my state was certainly this. No. You can only live with yourself if you use that vote. I know I will be doing it. And I think John Lewis, do it for John Lewis. Do it for this person who literally, in this country, until the Voting Rights Act of 1965, millions of people who were American citizens, who were paying taxes, were kept from the ballot. Because that is the only thing that can call your representatives to account. So that's what I would say. I think this, do it for John Lewis, I would say.
Beautifully put. Thank you, everyone. Please follow Mary. She's M. Curtis, NC3 on Twitter. And her website is marycurtis.com. Remember, this is the only country in the world where an entire political party, a dominant political party, is fighting to keep people from voting. Every other country in the world is expanding political rights when it can, all leading democracies. We're not talking about Russia. We're not talking about places that are not democracies, but they want more people to vote. In this country, the idea that more people will vote scares some people and many people. Thank you so much, Mary, and have a great Saturday, even as you mourn the life of Representative John Lewis.
I'm going to smile when I think of him. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you. You're listening to Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. I'm your host, Sri Srinivasan. Please tweet me at Sri, S as in Sam, R-E-E. And my email is SREE@SREE.net. But please call in. We want to hear from you. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. You heard Mary mention topics like the rent and evictions. Well, we have the perfect person to talk to you about that topic. Tahitun Maryam is with us. She is an activist, a poet, a writer, and the founder of Mutual Aid Network in the Bronx, the Bronx Mutual Aid Network. And she has been a longtime community activist and organizer who's been living and working in the Bronx, focusing on immigrant justice, civic engagement, and building community power through political education. Tahitun, thank you for your patience as you've joined us. We are so grateful for your time on a Saturday. Tell us about, well, the first question is always, how are you? How's your family doing through this crisis?
Hi, Sri. My family's okay. It's, we're kind of in a situation that I think a lot of families are in. My parents are currently in Bangladesh, and they've gotten stuck there due to COVID. And then I have friends, you know, whose parents are stuck in the States, but they're hoping to go back. So it's a bit of a precarious time for many of us, you know, but we're so far so good, healthy. So I thank, you know, God for just, like, at least having the basics of health intact right now. Thank you for asking. How are you guys doing?
Oh, thank you for asking. I appreciate it. We are so grateful that we are safe here in New York. And New York, as I said, was kind of a basket case at one point. Still, there are too many people dying, too many sick people, but we are in such better shape than we were. And we want everyone who would like to call in to do so, to talk to Tahitun and to talk about these issues. So first, let me reflect on what you heard already, and then tell us about the Bronx Mutual Aid Network, and also how are things in the Bronx right now?
Sure. You know, the Bronx really went through a lot in the past few months. I think only now am I getting a chance to step back and breathe a little, because at the height of the pandemic, right, during the months of April and May, when there was just ambulances roaring through the streets, the death numbers were obviously very high. We really suffered a lot in communities across the Bronx. And I think doing mutual aid work, which is obviously creating this like community network of neighbors coming together, looking out for each other, caring for one another, really also showed us how much there was suffering due to COVID. Places that are obviously more working class, you know, have a lot more socioeconomic distress, right, have really struggled during COVID. And I think, you know, only now are people starting to kind of figure out, you know, what the rest of the summer or what the fall is going to look like. But I think people are still very much scared. I think there's a little bit more activity now of people coming out. And, like, you know, I think it's really hard not to be outside during a New York summer. But I think people really need to still be careful because, as we've seen, coronavirus has really created huge rifts in our community due to the grave losses that we've faced. My own family also went through a COVID loss. And I think, you know, a lot of folks are really still in this period of grieving. And through mutual aid work, we're able to really look out for one another and care for one another and really check in on one another. And I think that's like what's most important during this moment, to just make sure that people's needs are being met, that we're not forgetting about anyone, that, you know, if you have elderly people that live in your building, you're making sure that they're getting, you know, the due food and medicine and whatever else their needs are, those needs are being met.
Thank you for telling us about that work. Tell us how you, before we come back to you, Taito, and we have a caller who's been waiting very patiently since the previous hour. So we're going to go to that caller. Tell us where you're calling from and tell us your name, please. Hello? Oh, we may have lost that caller. I'm sure he or she will call back. Otherwise, we'd love to hear from you folks. Please dial in and talk to us, 212-209-2877. We're talking about activism and so much more, including tenant evictions and what is happening in the Bronx. But we can talk to you about anything, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. Back to you, Taiton. Tell us how you got involved in the work of being an activist.
Sure. I mean, you know, my work in activism and organizing actually came from a very early age. I've been organizing in the Bronx for about 15 years now. And, you know, I started when I was very young. And I think it's the reality of, you know, your identity and your life being politicized from a very young age due to a lot of different factors that play in. And I think, you know, socioeconomically, like being from a very working class Bangladeshi diaspora in the Bronx, right, really made me much aware of the sort of political factors that exist in my life and how policies really dictate how communities like mine are affected when it comes to education, healthcare, any of housing, any of these really important tenets of like existing in the city. So I've been organizing since I was like in my teenage years, and throughout the years have been focusing a lot on like youth empowerment and women, and really making sure that the central point of my organizing is really community empowerment, which means just hosting a variety of different programs, events, doing a lot of advocacy work, speaking to Bangladeshi media, and really making sure that we're working on this political education that a lot of communities need to develop in order for us to get to the next level of engagement in American society, which, you know, really personalizes a lot of these issues that people often see on TV and people feel that they don't have a control over, but really making folks realize, like, hey, if you're a taxpayer in this country, you have as much of a, or even if, you know, you're not and you live in this country, you have as much of a right because you're here to a lot of, you know, these services that government and other agents, other bodies of authority kind of provides, right? And I think a lot of the times, at least I'm speaking to the reality of the Bangladeshi community, which I work very closely with, is that because sometimes folks come from countries and societies where it's not democracy is not necessarily the primary sort of system that we're accustomed to, I think a lot of folks need that sort of reminder, right, that within American democracy, you have a lot of liberty and rights, and people fought for these rights. We were talking about John Lewis. Like, people like John Lewis fought for us to have the sort of rights that we do as people of color in this country. And it's all tied to the civil rights freedom movement, right? And so I think, like, a lot of my organizing has been going on for a very long time. It was more streamlined in the field of, like, really working with immigrants and lower-income communities in the past few years. As you know, Sri, I was with the city, and then I left the city earlier this year and started the Bronx Mutual Aid Network because I came back. I was abroad, actually, when the pandemic started, and I came back in mid-March, right, as we were going into lockdown.
Why did you come back?
I came back. You would not believe
it. I'm just joking.
Like,
I'm just joking.
Oh, why did I come back? I mean, it was pretty bad in Asia where I was. So it was just a situation where I'm like, I need to, it's choosing, you know, the lesser of two evils. I didn't know that the U.S. Was going to be exactly, you know, it was hard to tell in March exactly how COVID was going to pan out in the States. But in some ways, I think, you know, it's like, okay, it might be easier in the States because obviously I have health insurance and I have, like, accessibility to good, like, you know, medical structures that don't exist everywhere else on Earth. And I think that's also the other part of, like, COVID, right? There's so many gross inequalities, obviously, that is being exposed in American society, but I think, like, just internationally, you know, a lot of the time COVID in places like Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, whatever, you know, a lot of these sort of developing nations, like, there's a diagnosis is a death sentence, right? So anyway, I came back and I was like I was helping a lot of the community members that I've always been working with, but then I was also waiting for like a mutual aid network or something to form in the Bronx, and it wasn't. And I think, you know, being like that there wasn't a structure, I was like, okay, I have friends who are doing, who are running the Queens Mutual Aid Network, and I've had a lot of extensive conversations with them, and I set up the Bronx Mutual Aid Network. And within since the beginning of April, we've been able to help over 650 families. We've been able to help, like, you know, the elderly, undocumented, a lot of pregnant people, families in shelters, whether that's domestic violence shelters or just homeless shelters. So we've been really trying to fill the gap where we saw a lot of folks weren't receiving help from, like, city or state or federal government because they're not eligible for a lot of these programs of assistance.
Thank you, Taitun. Folks, you're listening to a conversation about the Bronx Mutual Aid Network. But even if you don't live in the Bronx, there's so much to learn from her about a life of an activist and a young activist who has worked in city government and then decided to go out and work on her own. Tell us about your experience in the city and what that was like. As you know, I was the chief digital officer of the city, and it gave me great access into understanding what a complex, complicated, wonderful, frustrating, special city New York is.
Right, right. No, it was wonderful that you worked for the city, and I was there for a brief time as well. Because I think people like us need to be on the inside, and I think people like us need to learn, how decisions are made to run a city like New York of, you know, 8 million plus people, and how does the engines work internally, right? So I think in my time working with the mayor's office, it was really interesting to learn about, you know, the different variety of programs, resources that we do have, and really strategize, like, how do we get people, you know, aligned with these programs so that they can, like, take, you know, have these benefits that are provided to them, because we're all paying tax, our tax dollars to run the city. And I think we should also have a better standard of living through the programs and through all the agencies that provide a lot of different services to people. I think it was great. I think it's like young folks like myself. I think people of color. I think a lot of like people who traditionally didn't see themselves in positions within city government should take jobs in city government in order to like help, you know, really provide that on the ground sort of perspective on decision making on a broader level.
Watch, folks, please call in and talk about any aspect of the COVID crisis or the economy or the phase we're in, we're opening up in New York, or you want to just talk about John Lewis. Please call us 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. In a few minutes, I'm going to play a clip from a professor who I interviewed earlier this morning who wasn't able to join us live, but we'll be sharing his thoughts in just a few minutes. Tyson, talk a little bit, if you can, please, about what people can do who are listening right now, who are feeling overwhelmed, out of work, out of opportunities, and don't know where to turn. If they're in the Bronx, they can turn to you. In other boroughs, what can they do?
I mean, I think it's really important to definitely, and we were talking about like voting and we were talking about political power. And I think, you know, a lot of the times we forget, like a lot of folks often forget that there's actually, you know, elected officials within your locality, within your district, that you should be like asking for whatever help you need, right? So for example, when we had a plethora of like folks who needed help with unemployment claims and whatnot, you know, we provided a lot of that support, but that's actually the functionality of, you know, our officials, right? Like, and the constituent affairs that they provide. So I think looking out for who's in your area, who are your elected officials in the area, and getting in touch with them for whatever help you need. Right now, we were talking about rents and eviction. That's a huge problem. And, you know, through our mutual aid networks of hundreds and hundreds of people, we've been receiving calls and emails about folks who are really worried about being put out on the streets. And, you know, the reason for these concerns is because, like, people really don't, people feel very stuck and frustrated right now, Sri, because, you know, we got that one-time payment of $1,200. And then after that, you know, some people got unemployment, others did not. Some people qualify for programs like SNAP, others do not. And, you know, working class people are very, very frustrated because now people have had to make very hard decisions to, for example, leave their place of employment, who, you know, like food service jobs and whatnot, when coronavirus started and the lockdown began in New York, because they were like, you know, if I continue working, let's say in this Popeyes or Dunkin' Donuts or whatever it may be, I'm putting my risk at health. I'm putting my health at risk, right? And I think people had to make those decisions to leave those jobs, knowing that that job is not probably going to be waiting after things reopen. And so people definitely have a lot of frustration, and I understand that. I think the primary thing, number one, is to take care of yourself, like, is to find some time and place and environment to just center and just, like, really, you know, understand that this is something that is global. This is something that will be in for a while. And that's the reality of it, right? Without a vaccine, when we went into lockdown, we knew that it would be about 12 to 18 months at the earliest that we'll get a vaccine. So I think we just really need to take, you know, care of ourselves. We need to understand this is going to be a norm for a while. A lot of folks in New York are talking about a second wave. I don't even think we're done with our first wave, right? Because the numbers can very easily go high in a very densely populated city like New York, where, you know, housing situation is very crowded. A lot of folks that I know, like working class families that have, you know, 10 people living in a one bedroom, and it's bizarre, but then it's like, that's the sort of reality we're operating in. So I think people, in terms of where they can go to receive help, is looking to their local mutual aid groups within their neighborhood. I literally started Bronx Mutual Aid on Facebook. And then from Facebook, we grew into having, you know, a whole network of volunteers, about 120-plus volunteers that, you know, are working across the Bronx to support our neighbors. And so I think mutual aid is a really revolutionary, really great model because it really is all about that interconnectedness and that collectivism of really making sure we're seeing and standing in solidarity together, and not just saying it, but actually doing it by through actions, right? So plugging into mutual aid groups, making sure that if you need help, like reaching out to the elected officials in your area and making sure that you are receiving that help, as well as like just, you know, taking care of yourself, as I mentioned, because that's very important during these moments of crisis.
Thank you for sharing that, Taitun. Folks, you're listening to Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. And so let's go to the call-in part of our show. We have a caller. Please tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, my name is Charles Richard, calling from New York City. How are you doing today?
Thank you for your call.
Thank you. I was listening to, I believe it was Mary who had said before, you know, how to do this and how to go to the next step. And I believe that I have a complete plan that I believe is going to incorporate everything. And I think the word design is key. So I put something together with a partial quote. And I'd like to know if I can have your permission to read it. It's not too long. It's actually probably about a paragraph, maybe a paragraph and a half.
Go ahead. Keep it short, please.
Thank you. Absolutely. This is three pages. I'm only going to read one paragraph. So thank you. When in the course of human events it become necessary for one people, that's all of us, to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of our earth and have someone initiate a balanced remedy plan for our natural lives with design, now causing a new balance with ecology, business, people, and for our earth, and for people's guarantee of our government, not of our paternal habits for major money, suffering much primarily, taking liberty to say inadvertently, and okay, maybe not you now, but just gauge all of our sufferings on a scale from 1 to 10 and rate it of all. Seems only climbing. Do you want that to only continue, I ask? Do we find human reasons to agree or human reasons to separate? Because you can't do both simultaneously. We act anyway. Well, in our families, business, and in and from our government, too, and now globally, especially our police departments, where there are many good, and we all ourselves can take advantage of authority sometimes, and that many ways exist to do so. So here and now, we open that up. Also, how many types and degrees of outright sufferings exist to consider as part of open design? Do you want to only increase like now and pretend suffering doesn't exist at all? Or... and what about if it becomes on you, even if it's not you now? Is allowing suffering unconditionally your definition?
Charles, thank you.
American?
Charles, that's longer than a couple of paragraphs, but I really appreciate it. Where can people learn more about what you're writing?
Thank you. Time to join, TimeToJoin, and for those who were shocked slow, TimeToJoin, that's time to join .us. And also I also have a Zoom tomorrow night, and I'm running for the President of the United States, as well as I am getting some good coverage. I'm looking to go, of course, nationally. I see design plan needs to be opened up. We need to include every topic that you speak of openly, because that's what design
thank you, Charles.
Do.
Thank you, Charles, and good luck. We wish you the best. TimeToJoin.us is his platform. Thank you. Let's go back to Taitun. As you're hearing from our callers, as you've heard from Mary, what gives you hope in the middle of all of this that we can come out stronger, that we can emerge better than when we went into this crisis?
You know, I think it's a time of really radical hope, Sri, because of the fact that, you know, often it's hard to see what's in front of us if we don't have the sort of rose-colored glasses that we've always worn to kind of, you know, see this country, like, off for a moment so that we can... And coronavirus has done that, right? It's really shown us the systematic inequalities across many sectors of society, and I think... this is our second sort of shock point after the 2016 election, right? I think a lot of people started getting much more civically engaged, much more aware, much more invested and interested in really making a change locally within their community. And I think now with coronavirus, a lot of folks are even more in focused on the local. And I think it's a time for radical hope because of the fact that when we talk about returning to normal, we're not talking about the normal that we existed in, but we're talking about creating a new normal. We're talking about really making sure that we're not just brushing over the issues that we've seen, but also like tackling it full on, head on. When we talk about, for example, rent cancellation, right? Or what's happening with police brutality in America, right? We're not just saying, hey, we need a temporary fix to kind of pacify this issue. But like activists, organizer, youth, the young folks, right, are really coming forward and saying, this is not the community and the world that we really want to be living in 20 years from now. And I think, you know, we need to hold accountability we need to bring accountability into the question, which means learning about how systems work. So, like, all these young folks I've seen, like, on Twitter that are organizing around, you know, the defunding NYPD or doing other work where they're really looking into budget justice, right? And that's something that's, like, you know, you wouldn't think young folks would necessarily be into, right? Like knowing how budgets work, but it matters, right? Because at the end of the day, like how and where and in which ways we spend our money as taxpayers really matter. And I think it's really riveting to see so many folks stepping into this arena and saying, this is my future we're fighting for, and I'm going to be part of that conversation. So I think, like, I've just seen so much beauty in this moment, despite all of the losses and anguish that we've all been facing, is people that are saying enough is enough and it's time to act. And it's not just about, you know, people making providing false words, but what are the actions we're seeing, even with like corporations that are putting out statements. But a statement at some point might have been enough. Now it's not. Now it's like people are like, okay, a corporation put out a statement about Black Lives Matter, but like, let's look at their hiring practices. And I think the fact that we've gone to that second point of like, you know, action-oriented change is really beautiful. And I think I'm really excited and hopeful for what's going to be coming up in the next few months, years after. And obviously, like, voting is so important, right? And I think a lot more people are engaged. I don't think we're necessarily there yet where people are, like, really seeing the direct correlation of, like, how voting really impacts, like, who is in power and what sort of decision-making powers that they have, right? But I think more people are aware of it, and I'm really looking forward to having a lot of hope for November.
Thank you, Titan. We're now going to listen to a clip of an interview I did with Professor Manu Bhagwan, who is a professor of history and of human rights at Hunter College and at the Graduate Center at CUNY, the City University of New York. And I asked him to reflect on the legacy of John Lewis. And my first question was, how does he feel this morning about the passing of Representative John Lewis?
Well, at a personal level, it feels very personal. Let me put it that way. It feels very personal. It's I feel sad at a personal level. But one thing that strikes anyone who's about John Lewis or ever interacted with him at, in a personal way, would know right away is that sadness was not something that he abided by. He was, one might say, hopelessly optimistic. He never let grievance or bitterness, and he talked about this. I believe President Obama quoted him on this point recently. He never let those kinds of sentiments get in his way. He was someone who said, just keep at it. And that's his message to us now. We just have to keep at it. We have to find ways to get in the way, to make good trouble, and to live up to this man's incredible legacy.
Thank you. What is your thought on what his legacy means for all of us?
You know, John Lewis was a living legend. He brought the civil rights movement to our time. He was the last of the Big Six. He was the last living speaker of the March on Washington. Throughout his life, in all the challenges that he faced, he maintained an unbreakable commitment to nonviolence. And he faced horrific violence in all of his campaigns. He would go rushing headfirst into those challenges, where he was often beaten brutally. I don't think we should romanticize the violence that he suffered. It was horrific. And he nearly died several times in doing all of that. So if you ask, what does John Lewis mean now? What is his legacy? I think his legacy is twofold. One is that we must maintain his faith in nonviolence, his unshakable, unbreakable faith in nonviolence. And secondly, with all the adversity that he faced, and coming from incredibly humble beginnings to the leadership positions that he held, I think we must value his faith in optimism and forceful positivity, his belief that things can change, his faith that things can change however long the road is. And the road is long, but, you know, at the end, there shall be justice.
Thank you. In terms of young people, you are a professor, you teach about civil rights. I've noticed how much of an appeal he had to young people. How do you account for that? And why is he so relevant to young people today? And how should they be looking at his message as we look forward?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's one of the things. John Lewis never sat on his laurels. He was always at the forefront of campaigns up until the very last moment. I think the last public photo of him was with Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms in Atlanta at the Black Lives Matter mural that she had assembled. I think, you know, he was perturbed by the continuing violence against Black people in the United States. But he saw hope in the Black Lives Matter movements and protests that have broken out since the horrific murder of George Floyd. I think that people saw in him genuineness, empathy, that he heard them. They felt heard by John Lewis. And he was inspirational, but he was inspirational precisely because he was so humble, and he knew that leadership meant that you must feel the other people in the room. You must feel them, and you must cherish and push them forward. in order to in order to truly in order to truly make a difference.
Those are the remarks of Professor Manu Bhagwan, who teaches human rights, history, and much more at Hunter College and the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. Let me ask Tayton Merriam, our guest, who is the co-founder of the Bronx Mutual Aid Network, for her thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's right on par with everything that's been going on. I mean, it really is a moment for us to reflect, right, and kind of really think about the sort of moment that we've been living in, where we want to move towards. And I think this sort of radical and re-envisioning is really, it's really powerful right now. We're seeing a lot of folks who are reimagining what, you know, American society can look like when it's inclusive of us. I think that's wonderful. And it's a moment for, yeah, many of us to just reflect on systems and how we're going to work collectively to try to change it.
Thank you. On your Twitter handle, I love looking at people's Twitter handles because it tells you a lot. Sometimes I like it better than looking even at their LinkedIn, because LinkedIn is all kind of the things that they have to document.
Right,
I think you get
jargon.
To have your own, you know, your look at the world, or how you want to show yourself to the world, is what I think of Twitter for, and Twitter bios. And yours says poet, activist, organizer. You have a rose and a flag of Bangladesh, and you say you're a feminist, a politico, a field and digital communication strategist. You're the co-founder of BAPPNYC. Talk about that for a second.
Sure. So BAPPNYC is the Bangladeshi Americans for Political Progress, and it's a platform that we launched last year. It's a coalition of 20-plus progressive individuals from the Bangladeshi community. And many of us work in a variety of, you know, platforms and spaces, from just grassroots organizing to more working for city agencies to working for nonprofits, as well as those who work for elected officials like AOC. So many of us came together and we realized that, you know, Bangladeshis in New York are very high in number. We're about, don't quote me on this, but we're like nearing 100,000, right? And I think that's a significant population of people that needs to be heard and be centered when it comes to policies. And I think the way to do that is by creating a very powerful voting bloc. So we've been focusing on all the neighborhoods across our diaspora, from Brooklyn, the Bronx, Queens, to really bring folks together to do a lot more education around, you know, how politics in this country works, how, what are the positions of power, how do people, when people need help, you know, for, let's say, housing, they should go to a state representative versus, like, someone who is on the local level and doesn't have jurisdiction over those decisions, right? So we've been really making sure that we're focusing on our community, focusing on building a lot of awareness and education within our community, because I think right now, if nothing at all, I think knowledge is really, really crucial. And I think to do that education work with a language justice lens, right? So making sure that we're not only reaching out to people in our community just on like a digital platform and whatnot, but being very creative about it, like talking to our ethnic media channels, really making sure that we have more dialogue around a lot of these issues on a household basis as well, and framing that, those sort of conversations. So it's been really important. We just did a couple of endorsements for the June 23rd primary, and yeah, it's been amazing, because now we're just building up this really powerful Bangladeshi voting bloc, and Bangla being one of the top 10 languages spoken in New York City just goes to show you how many of folks there are from our community here who are dealing with a lot of working class issues, and we as a political group are very interested in just creating more of a holistic platform for working class voices from our community to be heard.
Thank you for sharing that. And I think it's fascinating to see the work you've been doing. We're so grateful to you for your hard work. And thank you so much for sharing it with us. Tell us how people can support you and your organization.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sri. This was amazing. I really appreciate you and everything you do. In terms of supporting the Bronx Mutual Aid Network, we are still collecting donations. So if you're able to donate, whether that's $5 or $50 or whatever you're comfortable with, that would go a long way. A lot of the early donations we received have just been going into buying bulk amounts of groceries and just literally getting it out to families in need that really have been struggling with food insecurity during the coronavirus crisis. And now we're also going to be helping with some very small financial grants that we can provide to undocumented families that aren't receiving any support from the state, federal, or city level. I know there's a small grant, but, you know, of like, I think $20 million that is allocated to the undocumented communities in New York City, but that's such a small bucket of money for a large population of people. So we're really, through mutual aid, trying to fulfill the gaps where we see them. So donating really helps. And if you live in the Bronx, you know, you can volunteer with us. We have been doing deliveries. We're planning a couple of food giveaways to people because, you know, there's all these food pantry lines in the Bronx, and they've just been, like, really long and overwhelmed. So if we can help alleviate some of these issues, we definitely will. So definitely do support. And if you can't financially support, just let people know that there's a mutual aid group that's doing borough-wide relief work in the Bronx.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Congratulations on your work. You've really found your calling, and you're helping hundreds and hundreds of families, thousands of people. Thank you very much. Tahitun Mariam is our guest. Please follow her at THATIUN Tahitun on Twitter, and also the BX Mutual Aid Network. You can find it, Bronx Mutual Aid Network, if you look on Twitter. Thanks very much, Tahitun. And before
Thank
we
you
leave
so
you, I'm just going to play a little clip of John Lewis's speech at the March on Washington in 1963, and then I'll be back to say goodbye in just 60 seconds.
Reservation, however, unless Title III is put in this bill, there's nothing to protect the young children and old women who lose jobs and fireholders in the South while they engage in peaceful demonstration. In its present form, this bill will not protect the citizen of Danville, Virginia, who must live in constant fear of a police state. It will not protect the hundreds and thousands of people that have been arrested upon Trump charges.
And with that, we want to say thank you to John Lewis for an amazing life. You can catch all the recordings online very easily. We want to thank you for watching and for being a supporter of this show. Please support WBAI. Go to WBAI.org, make a donation. For all the programming like this that brings you accurate news, information, entertainment. And we want to thank you for being a listener and an active participant. You can email me, sree@sree.net, sree@sree.net. Stay safe out there, folks, and stay home if you can. Please wash your hands, wear a mask. We'll see you next week. We're going to leave you with Could You Be Loved?, the 1980 hit by Bob Marley, a ballad to the poor yet welcoming people Marley met in Brazil. Thanks for listening to our show and supporting WBAI. See you next Saturday, noon to 2 Eastern. ¶¶
$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
CDC is working to help keep you and your community safe from the threat of a novel or new coronavirus. There are steps you can take now to get ready if an outbreak occurs in your community. Make a household plan. Learn how to prepare and to take quick action if someone gets sick. Older adults and people with chronic medical conditions are at greater risk. Take extra steps to protect them. Think about what you will do if there are changes to your work schedule. And remember to always practice good health habits, such as frequently washing hands with soap and water, staying home when sick, and covering coughs and sneezes. For more information, visit cdc.gov.
On July 18th and 19th, the Concert for Cuba will be live-streamed from Havana on Hot House Global, uniting 50 of the world's legendary supporters of Cuba's humanitarian efforts during the COVID crisis. Join Danny Glover, Michael Moore, Los Vanvan, Omara Portorundo, and Eliades Ochoa, and so many more in this epic event. Info at hothouse.net. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
Folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the